I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Dressed is an exhilarating book. Moves from a yellow Chong Sam. Some of you in the room may be too young to know what such a thing is, but well, of course you know. But in the 1949 film Love in the Mood for Love, to at the end Paddington Bear his suitcase on Paddington Station. And on the way, it explores the meaning of frocks, of suits, of shoes, and handbags. And it looks at their secret life. This is the subtitle of the book, The Secret Life of Clothes, of everything that we wear. And Shahida evokes most finely textures, fur, feathers, silk. And she examines feelings. She attaches to these material objects the range of pleasures. This is a book that's very much about pleasure, about seeking pleasure. And anxieties, of course, the embarrassment, the attachments, the detachments that clothes arouse. And it's interspersed with startling glimpses of autobiographical moments in Shahida's life, a kind of secret beneath the secrets. Now, she visits throughout films from Hitchcock, Fred Astaire, Tarantino. She reads all kinds of writers. There's an excellent passage on Jeeves attempting to get Bertie looking properly fitted out. Sensitive readings of Wolfe, of Charlotte Perkins Gilman. It's really a feast of a book, and it's unclassifiable. I mean, it's cultural studies, broadly speaking. It's film theory. It's psychoanalysis, it's literature studies, so it's above all, I think, a supreme example of the new kind of essay. Exploratory, reflective, full of a personal energy of Shahida herself, but also a wide knowledge that is accessible for us all. So, Shahida, how did you think of writing this book?
I'm quite overwhelmed hearing you talk about it. That's very strange. It's a very strange thing, spending a long time working on a book and then seeing it and seeing people pick it up and then people like Marina read it. Because you feel like you've written it in your own personal hieroglyphics and then somebody else reads it very precisely, sometimes in unexpected ways, but hopefully in the ways that you intended. So your secrets are not so secret anymore. So that's really wonderful to hear you say that. I it's so hard to answer that question of where the book came from. I've sort of started to reverse engineer it in my head. I think you know from writing books that books come from all over, from all sorts of experiences and thoughts and trajectories in our life. And now looking back at this book, I can see several different routes into it. One's a very prosaic one, which is that I was working in philosophy and I wanted to write quite a hard philosophy book. I wanted to use lots of stuff I knew and read and had thought about that I thought was profound and interesting, and I wanted to lend it to something that I wanted to write a phenomenological book, about a book about the experience of everyday life. That's the kind of philosophy I like. So I wanted to write a book about everyday life that people would understand, would read, and would be able to see and feel my world. That was the first part. But now looking back, I think that it was almost inevitable, this book. I've spent my whole life. I don't think I'm a particularly snazzy dresser. Lots of people know me, who have seen me with pen over my face and holes in jumpers. But I am obsessed with other people's clothes. I know, like this incredible jewel-like dress that Marina wears.
It's a tribute to you. I felt I had to dress carefully.
This is the terrible error I made writing the book, that I didn't think that I would have to think about what I wear every day afterwards, which I do now. But I have always thought about clothes, and I think it's something to do. People who know me will know I have a very odd, I have a very peculiar memory, and I remember lots of things that you probably ought not to remember, but I remember. But my earliest memories are of wearing, I have very early memories, being about two and pulling on a pair of floral pants to swim in a paddling pool. And I have memories of my parents buying things for me. I was the first girl after three boys, a 7-year gap between us. My parents had just come to this country. And my mother wore saris and salwar kameezes, and she couldn't find the things that she wore here. But she had this baby to dress, and a girl for the first time. And so I had the most amazing dresses, like Carmen Miranda rockabilly dresses with coloured fruit on it, pink sailor dresses with collars and jangling gold. But just, I had amazing clothes as a child. And I have a form of synesthesia that means that I often associate colour and texture with people. If I have met you, I can see people I know really well. I will often remember the very first thing you were wearing, the thing you were wearing the very first time we met. I will remember it. My editor B, she was wearing harem pants. They were amazing. So my memory is very peculiar. And so it felt inevitable that if I was going to write a book about everyday experiences, it would be about the particular way that I experience the world, which happens to be through texture and colour and the amazing things that people often wear.
Do you want to read a passage to give us a sense of, a sense of the book?
I was going to read from quite early on. So, yes, this is about the secret life of clothes. Okay. So this is the introduction. Do clothes speak? They express us, of course, indicating affiliations and identities. And the word text itself retains a memory of a lost materiality connected to textile and deriving from the Latin texere, to weave. We read our lives into the things we wear, but they too can seem in possession of their own life. How could we not believe there to be some animating principle at work in the crisp, stiffened transparency of organza, whose bridal layering accomplishes a strength that belies its fineness, or the cobweb softness of gossamer, whose name ridiculously conjoins the Middle English for goose and summer? Isn't there a hint of coquettish nonchalance in chiffon, romance in voile? When we choose to read our clothes, our task is to find their precise and equitable translation in language. This is a challenge because dress in its fullest range intimates something of the diversity and delicacy of the lived experience to which words only falteringly reach. In dress, we impart some mysterious thought, quality, mood, or aspect only inadequately conveyed by any other means. And yet at times, our clothes seem also to solicit language. Think only of the t-shirt in that precise and rare shade that brings unbidden to your mouth the shape of the word turquoise. The belt on the beige buttoned mid-length jacket that makes it exactly a trench coat and nothing else. Or the soft, smooth warmth against our skin that is brushed cotton. The things we wear can elude our words, bringing language up close to its limits, but at other times they seem almost to be awaiting our articulation, the exact arrangement of words by which something particular, something known and felt, might finally make itself understood. This is why, if you love language, you might find that you love clothes too. Both possess the capacity for exactitude and evasion, revealing us as we are and protecting us from too penetrating a gaze. For this reason, what I write here is given as an act of undeniable disclosure. How could I tell you of the life of clothes if I were not also to tell you of the life of the wearer? And if I cannot take you to my barest heart, if I keep you at arm's length, then remember that in clothes we hide too, cloaking the most naked truths. This book comes only from the conviction that there may be in clothes that which language cannot contain, and something else in language too that might realize the life of clothes that is otherwise left unspoken. We think we dress for decency's sake, but what our clothes conceal is an indecent truth, difficult to bear and harder to confront with every passing moment, that we are embodied and yet fragile, unknowable to others just as they are to us. Our clothes in all their joy, range and color, brightly ward off death. We wear them valiantly, presenting an image of how we might wish to be remembered, dressed in place of the bare bones we must ultimately become. Clothes tell our stories, some that we would rather not tell, others that we hardly know ourselves. The clothes of those we love tell us how little we have known them, how failed we are by the brute fact of our mortality, and how insufficiently love shields us from this, and yet how little we think of it in the things we ourselves wear. Our garments are unequal to the ways in which we are loved, but all that language cannot articulate, the life of the mind, the vagaries of the body, is there, ready to be read, waiting to be worn.
Beautiful. Yeah. I think you can hear in that very clearly how, you know, I think your first book was on Keats.
Yes.
Yes, and Keats, of course, the great writer, great poet of colour and texture,
yeah,
and sensuousness. And I think the idea of the laboratory of language and the workshop of the clothes was also present in that passage. And I wanted to ask you a bit more about that, about this interest in craftsmanship and actually you're very precise, for example, on how shoes, the vocabulary of shoes. I learned many words from...
Oh, really?
Yes, like shank.
Yes,
she
has a shank. Yes.
On a shoe, and how there's such an architecture that goes into it. And you have quite a long passage of analysis of sports shoes and their development.
Yes.
So perhaps you could elaborate a bit on this interest in the craft of the clothes.
Yes. That's such a good question. I hadn't thought about that writing as I do, was a bit like assembling or making or crafting a garment. My agent said to me afterwards, don't you think there is a connection between the really precise ways you're trying to articulate something and the precise ways that clothes work and are made? And that's when I thought, yes, if you love language, maybe you love clothes too, which was my experience with lots of my friends. I became really interested in the technical stuff, the shoes chapter in particular, because when I started writing that, I kept thinking about the mountain of shoes that my parents have in their hallway. I don't know if you have that, like a cupboard, right? And how disrespectful we are in shoes, just literally walking in shit, walking around, you know, scuffing them on. I've got like a wonderful pair of suede boots that I scuffed on the escalator, and I'm so furious at myself. Like and the way we take our shoes off, when you press one foot down on the back, that's how when you go home, if you're wearing trainers, you'll squash the back of one foot with the trainer of another. But we're really disrespectful of our shoes, and yet our shoes are everything, right? They enable the diversity of our species. If you're a ballet dancer, if you're an athlete, if you're a mountain climber, nobody ever believes me, but I was an ice skater as a young woman. I skated. So I had to think about my blades and how to carry them in. Our shoes allow us to do all sorts of things and they enable our potential. And so I started to think about how performance shoes are a kind of architecture. They're engineered. And in fact, Zaha Hadid, the Iranian architect, designed a pair of amazing cantilevered shoes, a picture of which we have in the book. Yes. And that makes total sense to me that an architect would make a shoe. People who know me know I wear ridiculous shoes because I'm so small. But the shoes that I became really obsessed with in the book were a pair of Nikes, and they really are the ugliest shoes you've ever seen. They're Cristiano Ronaldo's shoes from, yes, that's the cantilever heel, and that's the Nike Regista from Cristiano Ronaldo, which he wore at the last World Cup. And the reason I became obsessed with those shoes, I ended up ordering them on eBay for hundreds of pounds. Size 9, I'm a size 4.5. Football shoes, and they have this integrated sock liner, so you don't need to wear a sock, and which seems absurd and not that important, except it is important, because what it is about simulating a bare skin touch, so that your brain, which is connected to your body, which is connected to your boot, and then is in touch with the ball, there is this line of continuity, seamless, between those things. And although the ball was just a prosthesis, it was an extension of your limb, which is how Ronaldo plays. The ball so naturally belongs to him. And that boot is engineered to permit that kind of touch. And if you ever see him move, he has this very rapid change of direction. The boot facilitates that. I mean, I'm sure he could do it anyway, but the boot assists him. And it looks reptilian. It's sort of luminous, and it has sort of a rippled skin. When it arrived, it's like an alien had landed in my house. So I became really obsessed with the technology and the craftsmanship and how all of those things, despite the fact we disrespect our shoes, are geared to facilitating the most astonishing human accomplishments.
There are a lot of political undertones. The book doesn't exactly argue politically, but it gives a lot of food for thought politically, both the politics in this respect of sport and how that's related to certain sort of industries and problems of sweatshops and so forth. But also you have a lot of different gender politics, yes, undercurrents in the book.
That was a really deliberate decision, because there are two kinds of politics, I think, that you could see in the book. One which is about labour and sweatshops. And I have a passage about Marx at the very beginning and about commodity fetishism and why coats and our clothes are sort of the embodiment of what Marx meant by commodity fetishism. You know, the dress that has a flirtatious personality when you denude the worker of their identity in the making of the object, and the object takes on the personality. That is commodity fetishism. Mm. That is the swoosh on the Nike, the Nike trainer that tells you it has a life and the laborer doesn't, because you've forgotten that you just have this beautiful object. So I talk about Marx at the beginning, and the end of the book reaches towards sweatshops and the conditions of labor. And the reason it's not explicit, that part of the book, is because there are really terrific books about the conditions in which clothes are made. Lucy Siegel's To Die For is the one that I read about 5-6 years ago, and it makes you take your head into your hands. It talks to you about why... Remember that facetious line in The Devil Wears Prada about how, is it teal or a particular colour of blue and everybody loves that cerulean blue, right, has disseminated from the catwalk into your high street. And they never finish that story. It's disseminated from the catwalk into the high street, but it's begun in rivers in Congo that, you know, the colours that we wear are dyeing the rivers in places very, very far away from us. If you're wearing jeans, then your jeans probably come from a particular part of India where the women, it's a matriarchal society, the women who are handling the indigo dye, their hands are blue from dealing with it. Their fertility myths have got wrapped up in, if you're pregnant, you're not allowed to swirl the dye. So there's a whole kind of culture of, you know, where our clothes come from, and I'm interested in that. And that work, that polemical work, is already out there. I think lots of us are talking about it and campaigning about fast fashion. I think we know what we have to do, which is not just buy less and make do and mend. We need to challenge industry. But what I really wanted to do was write the book that made you think why you should care about your clothes in the first place. I didn't want to tell you what you should do. I think women, particularly like me in my 20s, buy ferociously to fill some hole in their life. And I don't blame them for doing that. I don't think we should chastise young women in particular for buying fast fashion. But I think we need to help people understand how meaningful clothes are. And I wanted to write a book where you would see clothes in all of culture and care about your clothes so that you might care then about the people who make it. So that's why the politics is subtle. It isn't supposed to smack you around the head. It's supposed to make you change. I want you to open your wardrobe and think about some of the things I've told you about, to pick up your jeans and think that there are women whose hands are blue and that jeans come from these other places. So it's a more subtle politics.
Well, I think there's exactly, and there's a sort of attentiveness to the conditions of our everyday life, and that deepens our experience. It's important. But you're more acerbic on the gender and feminist politics, and you have a truly powerful chapter. I suppose it's the whole chapter on the suit. I think there's something about on the male suit, which begins with a really devastating glimpse of your autobiography.
Yes, yeah, that was one of the hardest bits to write. The memoir parts are still really hard to... I can't bring myself to look at them. I'm looking at my editor at how hard it was to write those memoir bits and to share them. But in the book that I read, I don't think you can talk about the life of clothes without talking about the life of the wearer. But in that section, I talk about entitlement, about a kind of male entitlement, yes. And the violence that comes with the suit, which is sometimes physical, but it is all sorts of other things too. I remember after one of the terrorist attacks recently, there was a picture of a girl in a veil. I don't talk about the hijab in my book very deliberately too, but I remember the story about the girl in the hijab walking over the bridge, and there was a story about how unconcerned she seemed about the tragedy. And I remember someone tweeting that a woman in a hijab has done no harm to me, but men in suits have done so much damage to my life and culture, you know, the financial crisis. And I do think that there is a certain kind of unquestionable authority that the suit sometimes represents, and in the language of the moment, a kind of toxic masculinity that is the suit enables, facilitates. So I talk about the violence of the suit, but it's more than just physical violence. Mm-hmm. It's a
but also protection else. Too. I mean, the Cary Grant, yes. In North by Northwest is actually, and is it North by Northwest?
Yes, it's North by Northwest. Yes.
Because there's a lot of delight in your book. There's a lot of pleasure, delight, and you're watching these films, many, many different films, including Gloria Fred Astaire dancing, yes. Gene Kelly dancing, and thinking about the way they look through their clothes, and in the Cary Grant passages. It's actually a form of, I mean, he had how many suits made? It's the same suit.
Yeah.
It's the same suit, but it had to be made.
At least Ken Beverly Hills.
So you tell the story.
So it's, everybody knows the suit from North by Northwest because it's the single most famous suit in film history. And every time you watch an action film, if it's not a black suit, if it's that slightly gunmetal silver suit, it's echoing the suit in North by Northwest, which is amazing. And it's a really unusual suit because the trousers have forward pleats, which are quite feminine. So it's a rather unusual take. But the reason it was so interesting to me, that suit, is that it's an indomitable suit, right? He can duck under crop dusters and hang from cliff tops and seduce women, and the suit is, you know, unscathed. But he had 10 of them made. And in fact, there is a particular scene where he takes it off in the hotel room and you can see the label. And it says Quintana of Beverly Hills, which is a particular costume maker.
It was his tailor.
Yes. And he made everybody else in the film use his tailor too. So Martin Landau, who plays one of the henchmen, is wearing a suit made by his tailor, which I think is funny. But that story is sad too, because I say, you know, Grant writes this really amazing article in GQ in the late 60s about giving you advice. If you're going to get advice about a suit, you want it from Cary Grant. So GQ commissioned him to write a piece, and he talks about how you should be careful that you should always wear cufflinks, but be careful that your cufflinks don't scratch the enamel of your car or something like that. Which I don't think is a problem all of us have, but certainly not the car that he had. But his father had been a tailor's cutter, and that was so interesting to me because his father abandoned him as a child. And if you know the story, his father had his mother put in an asylum, and he thought she was dead for much of his young life. And then he discovered her, I think, in his 30s in an asylum. And so he has a very strange relationship to his father, who is a tailor's cutter. And yet he is this man who, if you close your eyes and think of him now, I bet you see him in a suit. Yeah.
Yes. But do you watch films only for research? Or are you watching films? Because you do watch films really, really well.
Thank you.
I'd seen several of the films you mentioned, but I'd not seen the things you see in them.
I think I was seeing them with my weird dress-based eyes. But I'm like you, like, in that. I think we're rapacious. We're magpies. We like all forms of culture. And it was really important to me to respect the film. So in the beginning of the book begins with sort of snippets, prologues, and I talk about Van Gogh's boots, which Heidegger writes about, very high culture. And then I talk about Madonna's jacket in the video for Borderline, which is my absolute favorite Madonna video. And I watch that on loop, but I knew it off by heart anyway. I talk about her denim jacket. Although lots of people love her jacket in Desperately Seeking Susan, I'm up to debate that. But I wanted the popular culture there as well. Because I saw,
yes,
part of the argument of the book is to say, philosophy certainly, the disciplinary, the rigid discipline that I sometimes try to belong to, pretends that it's not interested in clothes. And maybe academic studies pretends it's not interested in clothes, because we're interested in the life of the mind, and it seems superficial. And it seems to me, well, why is it that clothes are everywhere, in everything, in all forms of culture, not just because people are dressed, but in meaningful ways, they're freighted with significance. And if they are meaningful in all forms of culture, why are we ignoring them? And how can I draw out their ubiquity and their significance? So I was watching attentively to draw those things out, but I don't think you watch films without your eye being jabbed by, you know, the dress that, I don't know, Kate Blanchett is wearing in Carol or something, you know, the fur coat that she wears. My eye is jabbed by that in the film, and I think it's interesting that that's there. Mm. Why is it interesting? Mm.
You also make the point, actually, it's about halfway through the book, in the section on animals, which I really sort of flashed up very strongly for me, which is that it's sort of so obvious, I almost don't want to say it, but you discuss it so well, which is that it's a sign of the human. We are the only animal species that wears clothes.
Yeah.
And also, we wear animal species.
Yeah.
We wear leather, we wear fur. So that's in your section, a beautiful chapter on fur, feathers, and... I've got it. I marked it. If you don't know the page number, that is not a real pant. Someone gave it to me. It's old currency from Lebanon. It has no value, but of incredible beauty. Incredible beauty.
Amazing
here.
Bookmark.
Page 207.
207.
But
how could we ever deny that we are entangled in animals? Not least because we are dressed in them. Being dressed is such an essentially human experience, even as we know that we enter this life naked. The philosopher Jacques Derrida laughingly describes undressing before his cat, catching its impassive eye and being overwhelmed by an embarrassing sense of their parity, his own nakedness juxtaposed to that of his naked pet. The anecdote recalls the essayist Montaigne's famous philosophical cat conundrum posed in the wry question, how can I tell if I am playing with my cat or my cat plays with me? Who knows the answer to that? Certainly no self-respecting cat owner. What comes of Derrida's encounter, though, is a dawning realization that dressing is not only proper to, but a property of being human. With the exception of man, no animal has ever thought to dress itself, he observes. Dressing is like the utterance of speech or the exercise of reason, like laughing, mourning, history telling, and gift giving. It distinguishes us amongst the kingdom of animals.
Beautiful. Yes, wonderful.
You know, you're right, that part of the book is obvious in a way, but unseen, which is what clothes are like,
yes,
I think. They are obvious and unseen.
No, perfect. I didn't mean it
as a
criticism.
No, I know.
No, it's just that it's something that I hadn't ever sort of really understood.
Yes.
This, and it needs more attention, which you're giving it, because this adornment, this idea of adornment. But the adornment, which is for many, many purposes, for one's place in the world, for one's impact, for attracting other people and so forth, but it also has this facet, which you do look at, which is that it is often used to constrain.
Yes.
That there are, I mean, you don't go into the history of the corset, you mention it, but this, and you talk about high heels.
Yeah.
So what do you think the psychology of constraint is that sort of dominates so much of high fashion in particular?
Yes, yeah. I do talk about, this is a funny thing to talk about because corset historians have increasingly come out saying the corset was not repressive, the corset was structuring you, and there's something slightly kind of facile about the corset being oppressive. But it seems to me that so much of women's wear, the history of women's wear, has been inimical to the well-being of women themselves. Mm. Not just the things that they wear, but also the way that they're made. So I talk about the arsenic dye. Mm. There's a sketch by Tenniel, who's, you'll know him from the Alice in Wonderland illustrations, and he has a sketch called The Haunted Lady Looking in the Mirror Looking Glass, which is an echo of Alice, obviously, as well, I think. And it's a very thin, reedy young woman in a corseted dress and a billowing skirt gazing into the mirror. And in the mirror, you can see her reflection, and behind her, another young woman collapsed And that is Marianne Walkley, who was a real person. She was a dressmaker who had been working something like 27 hours straight, and she collapsed. And Marx writes about her in Capital, about the conditions of labour in which dresses are made. So I write about this perversity that women's wear has peculiarly so often been inimical to their well-being. And in shoes in particular, I became... So much of the book is about clothes as metaphors and how they're both metaphors for certain parts of our experience, but also the material conditions in which we exist. And so I talk about how shoes, women's shoes are, there's a history of constraint and discomfort, hobbling. I wear ridiculous shoes, so I know, like how gravity wedges throw your weight forward in this absurd way. And I talk about how the language of liberation is connected to mobility, the glass ceilings that we break through, the ladders we try to climb, the kitchens we leave behind, that mobility is a feminist issue, and that the shoe is both a metaphor for that constraint and a real part of the conditions of women's lives. And there aren't any easy answers, I don't think. I'm still wearing those ridiculous shoes because I love them. I know partly I wear them because I'm so small and I can try to get some leverage. If I talk to you later, you'll see I'll try and position myself in a particular way so that we have a level gaze. I'll never be able to look straight into your eyes. But I'll try to. And I'm constantly negotiating my spaces because I'm small. But I think women often are constantly, sometimes unconsciously, negotiating their spaces. And that embodied experience was something I wanted the book to say.
You sounded in the book, though, as if you used to run.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
nobody ever believes me, but I was an athlete as a child.
I believe you. It's very convincing in the book.
People keep asking, what's your favourite item? What's your favourite garment? And I think they think I'm going to say some magnificent dress. And then I say it's the Nike Magista boots. But also that chapter begins with me being about 12 or 13 at school and having a new gym teacher. And I was running, and I still think it was one of the crowning moments of my life, where the teacher just collared me. She just took me aside after the class, and she saw something, because I was really small and light. And if you have a low center of gravity sometimes, and you have a small frame, you can run like the wind. And I could when I was 12 or 13. I can't anymore, but I could when I was 12 or 13. I was a really good sprinter. And I remember there was that moment of recognition when somebody sees that you have something in you, some potential. And she put a pair of spikes on my shoes, and they were awful spikes, like in the school collection. They were blunt, not particularly good. But spikes are really light. They have a technology. They're light, and they give you the friction you need to be able to spring from the earth. And she made me run in the spikes. And I remember it was the fastest I'd ever run in my life. And I can still remember how exhilarating it felt to feel the wind behind me and leaving the other kids miles behind. And sometimes when I talk to athletes, people who play sports, I can see it in their eyes too, that moment where some piece of equipment, a shoe, a vest, facilitates this most astonishing, it enables something deep inside you.
Yes. And I think that the argument of continuity between the actual thing and a state of being comes through very well, but also in psychological states like reinventing yourself in a different, totally different shape.
Yeah.
So this is, as it were, finding your natural physical ability. But there are also lots of clothes in your book, lots of dresses in the book, that are ways of actually projecting a completely different self, particularly Alexander McQueen's work.
Yes.
And you comment on that and his sort of cruelty and his sadomasochism and the way that the women's bodies are encased and cut, choked and all kinds of things of that sort.
Yeah. I think people find him so difficult for those reasons. I don't talk about a great many designers in the book because it is a book about clothes rather than fashion per se. I talk about Yohji Yamamoto because the best fashion film ever is the Wim Wenders film, Notebooks on Clothes and Cities, about Yohji Yamamoto. It's much better than The Devil Wears Prada. But I talk about McQueen, and he comes up again and again because he's so clever. He's so intelligent. I think of him as a thinker, the ways that he identifies the relationship between women and birds in particular. But I also see that the cruelty in the ways that he contorts women and stages them. And I see, by the same token or in the same stroke, I see how deeply, how profoundly he identifies with them. He sees them, he presents them as victims because he sees them as vulnerable. And then he does something perverse and awful and sort of astonishing too, which is he says that victimhood could turn, that you, one of the most painful lines to write in the book was, he talks about seeing his sister beaten by the same man who then abused him too, and how he wants to make women look strong, even though they look like they've been victimized. But one of the most difficult things for me to realize, looking at his work and thinking about him, was that I think one of the things he's saying is that if you have been subject to violence or a victim in some way, then one of the strange things, difficult things you can do is that you can say that there is nothing anybody could do to me that is worse than what I do to myself, which is what I think he tries to do. He says, a woman wears this dress, she does this to herself because there's nothing worse that anybody can do to her than she does to herself. And he takes that as a kind of empowerment, which is perverse and terrible, but also sort of blindingly brilliant too. He has this dress, which is in the book, this bronze and gold sort of metallic dress, lace, and it looks like a woman, it looks like it's just been caught on the edge of a candle, that it's burning, it's just burnt. And it's absolutely vulnerable and delicate and just astonishingly beautiful too. Mm. Yeah.
I have very mixed feelings about McQueen.
Lots of people do.
Yes. I mean, I suppose his own biography does get mixed up into the clothes. But on the point of, I mean, the sort of psychoanalytical elements of these thoughts about his fashions, there are, you gesture towards such analysis every now and then. So there's a little bit about shoes and the famous, and there's fur, Freud on fur. but there's also about this idea of how of the masquerade, which I think in a way is the more interesting psychoanalytic point of how we dress in relation to others. We produce ourselves.
Yeah.
Please say some more about that.
I don't know that I can say it any better than you or you have. I talk about, some of it is, some of the time I'm reading philosophy and saying, look, all those years that people said to me philosophy or psychoanalysis was about this, but serious stuff, it's not about clothes. I'm reading that stuff and saying, no, look, there is a way in which you can think about clothes through this lens, and also there's a way in which clothes, and particularly women's experience of clothes, might illuminate this philosophy in a more dynamic or unusual way. It might cast it in a different way. And with Freud, I was thinking about screen memories, because the screen is, I think he thinks as a projector, doesn't he? But I think I say it could also be a textile, and I talk about the fabrication of memory, of childhood memory, how you fabricate things. There's a section in the introduction where I talk about how sometimes we're looking to present ourselves in a particular way to other people, and there can be no guarantee that we will be understood or we'll be successful in being able to do that. But there are things that we are saying or betraying nonetheless. That struck me as deeply psychoanalytical, of course, in certain ways, but also really true. I don't think you need psychoanalysis to understand that. We betray ourselves constantly in the things that we wear. We might think that we're a particular kind of person, that we're in we might be in control of what we say, but we aren't always. And the inverse of that too, that like, this was a really important part of the book, and I think a different part of the book to other books about dress. I didn't want to say clothes are about identity. That seems to me too banal, too obvious, that what we are could be somehow the sum of what we are could be expressed in a Ramones t-shirt, for instance. It seems so absurd that identity could be expressed so easily, so glibly. And it seems to me one of the things that we are is hiding, that everything, sometimes, maybe the thing that we are is the thing that we don't want to disclose, not even to ourselves. The thing that our clothes don't say, that we are constantly hiding in our clothes too. I know that's the case with me, that I'm not sure that these clothes are me. We're always looking for the thing that suits you, but I'm not sure that anything will ever suit me. Mm. I'm not sure I want you to see who I am. It's interesting to me that I want to try and present myself some way.
Yes. I mean, I remember, it's sort of slightly faded with age in my case, but I remember the sort of dreadful agonies of awkwardness when you think you're dressed properly for a party or for an occasion, and then you look at yourself in the mirror for the last time and you realise it's a disaster. and then you tear everything out of your wardrobe and try... And somehow that's because there's a mismatch between the image you thought you were going to be
Precisely
able to create.
So. There's the Virginia Woolf story I mentioned, A New Dress, which is sort of one of the adjacent stories to Mrs. Dalloway. And Mabel, poor Mabel. Mm. Mabel is exactly that. Mm. We've all been Mabel. Mabel is not beautiful or rich, and she's not young anymore, but she's been invited to Mrs. Dalloway's party. And it's this big moment in her social calendar, but she doesn't want to let on quite how big it is. But she plans for it meticulously and well in advance, and she commissions this dress. And I think it's in a yellow lace. And even as she's describing it, you know she's making a terrible mistake. So it has a high collar and a waist. In the 30s, 20s, it should be a dropped waist. But she spends all her money on it. And then she has that moment where she goes to the party and instantly she knows she's wearing the wrong thing. And you don't know if it's true. Maybe nobody else cast Mabel, but she thinks it is. And she sort of shrinks. And that horror just sinks that she's wearing the wrong thing. And that made me think, well, what is the right thing? And there's a passage from the French philosopher Sixu who talks about wearing Sonia Riquel, and the dress, she says the perfect dress is like water. It's like stepping into water. It envelops you, and it has a certain transparency, and that you will shine through the dress. And I sort of think, how dare she found that dress? Mm. And that we're all looking for that dress where that will be perfectly kind and just and true and transparent, not literally transparent.
But there's also the question of disguise, isn't there? The suit, well, your passages on the suit, they present the suit as a form of disguise. I mean, because it's architecture, women wearing suits are presenting themselves in a way to fit into some aspect of the world as perceived.
Well,
it's a sort of fancy dress almost. Even the trouser suit you talk about.
Yeah.
It's almost a fancy dress.
I don't spend enough time talking about women in suits. I wish I'd talked more. But largely because I spend so much time talking about dresses. But I talk about Janelle Monáe. I love Janelle Monáe. And Janelle Monáe wears, that's her uniform of choice. She wears tuxedos with embellished lapels and satin cuffs. And if you've ever seen the music video to Make Me Feel, which is the best song in the world after Borderline, she's flirting with her girlfriend, and she's flirting with her girlfriend and a potential boyfriend. She's wearing various suits, and I mean, the easy way to say is that she's queering the suit, but what does that mean? I think it's not that a woman is claiming the suit in order to be a man. I think sometimes women wear the suit to claim their own authority, to puncture the authority of the suit, to try and articulate it differently. And I also think that masculinity doesn't come out of that encounter unscathed. That masculinity is being challenged too.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so her suits are amazing.
Well, I think we might turn it over to the audience. I think there is a microphone.
You choose.
Yes. I was just going off what you'd said about Janelle Monáe in suits, because I love her as well, but... do you have any opinions on what Billy Porter has said recently about men wearing dresses?
Yeah, I don't have an opinion on Billy Porter's dress at the Met Ball, although it was a suit and then it was this incredible hybrid thing, but I feel exactly like Meryl Streep, if you saw the picture of Meryl Streep, just takes a double take when she sees him. I feel like that. But it is funny, isn't it, that hasn't caught on in the same way. The one thing that there are lots of things that aren't in the book. I sort of mentioned the hijab and particular reasons why I didn't want to talk about that. It seems that it's overdetermined in part of the public discourse. And I didn't talk about trans identity and dressing as men or women, if that's not your assigned gender at birth. And that seemed to me, I think all of us have a obligation to think about that, not just if you're someone who identifies as trans or not. I think it's part of our responsibility. But I didn't have anything specific to say on it. I didn't want to highlight it as an issue either. There's a line in the book at the beginning where I say, This is not just a book for women, it's a book for men and women and for anybody for whom those easy categories don't fit. And so much of the book is about that feeling of not fitting or trying to fit and finding the misfit, as it were. I wanted to write about not having that easy relationship with our clothes and without pinpointing any particular political issues. So I don't have thoughts on Billy Porter other than he's amazing, but it does seem to me interesting that it hasn't caught on in quite the same way.
Yeah,
if that's a sufficient answer. I had another idea and then it percolated and went. It'll come back.
I was thinking, you were talking about constriction in clothing. I was wondering if you had anything to say about the clothing that some people impose on others. So I'm thinking at one end of the scale you have sort of the old workhouse uniform, Guantanamo Bay. I mean, yeah. That orange suit is something that's seared on my mind. But also Even things like the hospital gown, you know, sort of uniforms, those kinds of clothing. Yeah, I mean, I was wondering if you had any thoughts on the power dynamics involved in obliging one person to wear something of your choosing.
I mean, all of the book is about that, in a way, about how oppressive gazes are, but also how oppressive clothes are. What it feels like to be... Guantanamo Bay is a really harrowing example, and you can immediately see the suit. But also on a more kind of mundane level, like if you ever worked in a shop or in an office and you had to wear this shapeless... I mean, I know that's not the same thing, but the discomfort of being made to parade, present yourself in a way that's so at odds with what you are. And I write about that discomfort, definitely. I think maybe I could have written more about the violence of that. But I think, and in certain situations, of course, like the one you're talking about, and the oppressive imposition of the hijab in places and veil, that's more than not just being comfortable in your skin. That is an infringement of rights too. But it seemed to me that's why you should write a book about dress, or you should read a book about dress. That so often we think that to be concerned with dress is to be somehow distracted by something superficial or vain. And yet so many of our most serious political and moral concerns about freedom, about gender, are articulated in dress or through dress. And I wanted to try and provide some of the resources to start thinking intelligently about those things. Yeah.
That was quite wonderful. Forgive me, Shahida, I haven't read your book yet, but that I think is, I have an excuse. I have the black and white version, which you told me not to read.
No, don't read it.
Right,
the
okay. Okay. I wondered if you'd talk at all about aging. And dress?
Yeah.
Because I'm having this memory of Marina, I think you were going in to give a Hilda Hume lecture, and I was introducing you, and we were standing in front of the mirror talking about length of hair as we got older. This is a joke, because it was about 20 years ago, but we were already having this conversation. And we both said, almost in unison, wait a minute, we make the rules. That's the point of being a feminist. Yeah. But I don't think we totally believe that. And I was brought up by a mother who would regularly say, when she was also still very young, what is most important is you never look like mutton dressed up as lamb, right? So there is a real sexual disparity between men and women on this, because men aren't expected to change the length of their hair or the way they dress as they get older. But women really are, and I wondered what you had to say about that.
No, I don't write at length about that, but I do talk about the tract by Zoe Moss. Do you know that tract? It's I think it's from the 1970s, and it's called. It's a really vigorous feminist tract for the aging woman, and it's called It Hurts to Be Alive and Obsolete. She says the aging woman is supposed to fulfill her small function and vanish. And she gets furious about that experience, that as though your sex is a void in the street as you walk through it. So I talk about that. And I talk about Simone de Beauvoir talking about young women, as an older woman talking about young women, and how young women are caught between the compulsion to screen themselves from being scrutinized and also to display, and how that is an kind of exemplary experience of femininity. So yeah, I talk about those two examples. In the culture that my mother comes from, you show less belly probably in your sari, but your colour palette changes, it dims. So you stop wearing fuchsia pinks or bronzes, you start to wear creams and whites, which it feels sort of almost funereal, like it's kind of odd. But it is interesting to me that the colour palette has to change with your age, and my mother's very conscious of that. And at the same time, I know she has the most awful sense of colour. Like, if something is a really angry mustard orange, she wants it. Like, that's impulsively the thing she wants. And I sort of trying to be encouraging her to buy the thing you want and wear the thing you want. Who are you pleasing in those moments? Yeah. But the Zoe Moss tract is one of the most remarkable things I read about aging.
Fascinating talk. Absolutely. And very interesting. And I was just thinking, if discussing men's suits from a male perspective, whether you think of an equivalent garment worn by women, for instance, perhaps the power of the miniskirt to bring down government.
Yeah, no. Yeah. Have you been to the Mary Quant show at the V&A? Yeah. Did the miniskirt bring down government?
Let's try it. Let's all try
anything.
It tomorrow.
It's worth trying anything at this if Boris Johnson does become Prime Minister, I mean, that is a surefire way to get his attention, to fell him, isn't it? To women, probably in miniskirts. In the Mary Quant show, which is on at the V&A at the moment, it's so much fun. I thought it would just be fun, but it's actually really thoughtful as well. There's lots of mums and daughters wandering around. The mums going, I used to have those, and the daughters going, sort of begrudgingly going, that's actually quite stylish, which is true. And in fact, when I was on the coming on in the tube today, because I'm so distracted by clothes, there's a girl in a kind of quite an expensive satin that's not shiny, but is a slightly textured, but it's so smooth, and it was green. It's a halter neck. In the Mary Quant has a stripy halter neck dress in that show, and she had a version of it, and she wouldn't have realised it was Mary Quant. But it was green and white, so she looked like a long squirt of minty toothpaste. It was really beautiful. But it was the Mary Quant dress. But Mary Quant, the curators have had a sort of an issue. They're always caught up in this debate about whether Mary Quant invented the miniskirt, and she didn't invent the miniskirt, somebody else did. It was a man, annoyingly. But she popularised it.
Yes.
And that seems to me enough. And one of the curious things I found out about Mary Quant when thinking about that exhibition recently was that there is an idea that radical culture comes about as a direct response to the restraint and the constraints of the war, but also that she was a child evacuee, and that if you are that generation of young people who are parted from their parents and forced to be resourceful to fend for themselves, I talk about children fending for themselves in the chapter about bags, but if you're a child evacuee like that, then one of the outcomes of that, you might be a generation that is that much more daring and self-sufficient. And there is a whole idea that the Mary Quant collection, her innovative business models and the work she was making is a sort of product of that experience of being forced to fend for yourself and having daring, which I think is really interesting. Yeah.
I first saw Mary Quant herself in the street wearing one of her geometric short dresses outside the Establishment Club, which was the club that Peter Cook and Dudley Moore started, which was full of, you know, extraordinarily subversive, completely what not wouldn't be allowed now. I mean, very, very unbuttoned criticism.
Really?
Yes, and satire. So you're completely right. The two were absolutely symbiotically the rebellion against the establishment.
Yeah.
It was a joke calling the nightclub the establishment.
Yeah.
And the clothes.
Yeah.
It was part of a... But yes, a revolution, really.
You were hanging out with the best people.
No, I wasn't hanging out. I just saw
you.
Her. No, I wasn't.
You
no,
were, I'm sure
no,
you
no,
were.
No, I wasn't.
All over.
Anyway, is there another question, or if not, we... Yes, there's another one.
Really,
oh, good. Okay.
I love the book, particularly the chapter about bags. But there's one character I'd like to redeem. When you're talking about Jeeves, there's a character whose name I can't remember, who doesn't get up, who wears his pajamas till late in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And if he does dress at all, gets into a holy jumper. And I just wondered if you, he's not the hero of your book, but I wondered if you'd just say a little bit about that experience of wearing clothes, where you, the clothes you don't perform in, they're not display, you just slob around in them.
That is, it's not Pongo Twistleton. Pongo Twistleton has the party that Jeeves is really concerned about dressing for. But it is, oh, I know, it's Gussie Finknottle, isn't it? And actually, it's so interesting you mentioned you, because Marina's got a personal connection, don't you? It's so funny.
It's very funny on that page,
Because I talk about, that section, it was intended to be amusing, and you're right, he's sort of indolent, and he likes to spend his time, Woodhouse is so funny, isn't he? He says that Gussie likes to spend his time lounging around his pyjamas, but also watching worms. And just to answer your question before I go into Marina's thing, but I remember talking with Francis Corner, who's the head of the London College of Fashion, one of the most stylish people you'll ever meet. And I remember we were in a debate together, and she said, somebody asked her, what do you like to wear at home? And she said, she wears Yohji Yamamoto religiously. She's incredibly stylish. And she said, almost unthinkingly, she said a onesie. And I was just really bewildered about it. And Private Eye did a sketch, a caricature of me a couple of months ago, writing my book, Dr. Shahidabari, Dress, the Secret Life of Clothes. And the cartoonist had done me in my pyjamas with a towel on my head and like discarded bits of biscuit and cups of tea around, which is actually how I wrote my book. And I was like, how did he get a long lens into my window? So I have a lot of time for the stuff that you lounge in. And also my husband, who I think you met maybe, is the sort of person that who is really good at lounging. Like, I think you can be the sort of person who's really good at finding the thing that just makes... So when he first got together, I remember he found a pair of my leg warmers. And he put them on as slippers, and he just wore them. He's like 6'5", I'm 4'11". And he wore my leg warmers. He was just so comfortable in my leg warmers. And I remember that some people are really are content in their skin and in their clothes and have a natural talent for making themselves at ease. But the Jeeves connection is that I talk, this is more sober, I talk about the comedy of the relationship between Jeeves and Worcester, but also that Percy Jeeves, Jeeves is based on a real life cricketer called Percy Jeeves.
I didn't know this, by the way.
Oh, no. Well it's an incredible story, because the stories feel so bucolic. English country green, village greens, cricket, except that the war doesn't happen in the stories. And Percy Jeeves was killed at war. And so I think there's something really sort of plungent and moving about the fact this really profound and tender relationship between these two men, Jeeves and Worcester, which is predicated on one caring for the other's clothes. Jeeves is a valet. Is that the name comes from this cricketer and your grandfather?
Yes, was going to pick him for the England team.
Yeah.
But he died before he was picked. Yeah. And before he could play.
Yeah, it's a remarkable
But
story,
actually, it's also because my grandfather's nickname was Plum, which is the same nickname as Woodhouse.
Right.
So that's how the connection was built up.
Did your grandfather invent cricket? Somebody said that to me.
I think we'll set this conversation aside. There's another question there, yes.
I was just wondering, you talk about the sort of signalling of clothing, and I think especially, I don't know if it's covered in this way in the book, but it seems like especially for women, you know, every outfit is some sort of message. And I was just wondering whether you think that women will ever be able to escape that dialogue and whether they need to. And I suppose, you know, at the moment, the high street maybe plays on that sort of ferocious language that we have and maybe insecurity that we have to kind of wear the right thing at the right time.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you think that we'll ever kind of grow out of that and if we need to.
Yeah, I don't think I can answer that question, but I entirely understand what you're saying, and I try to articulate that experience, that enormous... and sort of almost unconscious burden that at any given moment a woman is being assessed for her appearance, for her anatomy, for what she's wearing. I have this vague thought that maybe what we really are in our most private moments is a thing that we don't wear. It's a thing that we don't give away in what we wear. And that burden of being constantly scrutinized is erosive and hard. But also, it is the exemplary experience of being a woman. And actually, this connects to your question about trans identity. It seems to me so much of the experience of being a woman is about the experience of failing to be a woman, failing to be thin enough, or beautiful enough, or fertile enough, or maternal enough, or fashionable enough, that to the point that I start to think that failure is what it means to be a woman. And somehow, every day, we clothe this body and go out into the world with it. And I know the book is for men too, and men love clothes too. People say that all the time, and I say, yes, I write about men and clothes, but I do think that the nature of women's bodies and women's experience means that we have a very particular experience with our clothes. And it also enables us. I think that it means we can have a kind of out-of-body experience, that we're not just being looked at, we're seeing ourselves being looked at. And the moment, you know, when you look in the mirror just before you leave your house and you adjust your dress, or you fix your, I should have fixed my hair before I got here, you know. Those moments where you pause and have a second thought, is this top too low? Will I have to pull this skirt down? Women have that all the time, right? But that moment where you see yourself outside of yourself is an ethical moment. It's the moment where you can have and the kindness that you can't extend to yourself in those moments when you're really hard on yourself, I think you can extend that kindness to others. And I think women have that facility in a particular way.
Yes, well, I think that, you know, this personal investment in the book that you have, you know, this sort of sensitivity to states of being, it's really, I mean, it came through in that last reply. And I think, anyway, we all thank you very, very much for a wonderful book and
thrill.
A wonderful
talking to you.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.